welcoming Robert Cohen for this segment, Homely and Freakin'. Welcome back, my dude. Welcome back.
Hey, Cameron, it's like you're my old pal at this point.
We know each other. We're at each other's houses all the time.
Yeah, but like this is like our third one, and now we're like, you know, we're going to share family dinners and whatever.
Maybe even TV dinners.
Yeah, that'd be good. Did you have TV dinners when you were a kid with peel back?
I still do, my dude.
All right.
Some great spinach and cheesy broccoli that you can eat.
Oh, dude, Salisbury steak.
Oh, yes. Oh, man. And that's before you realize how much sodium you got in them.
I think TV dinners are part of what they ground up into making that pea soup for Linda Blair.
Yes. I was about to say, because like whatever's in our bodies, you know, is also in our souls. And that's kind of what freaking focuses on. So when did you get into his violent terror films and hard-boiled douchebag cops, you know, out for vengeance? You know?
Yeah, I'm not really sure. I mean, let me take a look, but I'm pretty sure, you know, The Exorcist might have been the first one that I knew it was a William Friedkin film. But, you know, actually, I got to say, no, I may not have seen The Exorcist first because in 77...
It was almost restricted.
Which is the year we know because it's basically... BST and AST, you know, before Star Wars and after Star Wars. We all know 77 is that year. And of course, obviously, that was the year that Sorcerer came out, the film that nobody was going to see, and they blamed it for all those other reasons. Mm-hmm. So in 77, I would have been either in junior high school or a freshman in high school. And, of course, I knew he had done The Exorcist, and I was intrigued by the name. I'm like, Sorcerer, and look at that picture. It looks so cool. I mean, I got to see this. And even though it was R-rated, somehow I, you know, got into the theater. and I was so blown away by how fucking awesome it was. I remember being frustrated throughout the whole thing, going, what's the Sorcerer? I don't get it. And even when it was over, I'm like, what the hell was the Sorcerer? That part didn't make any sense. Only later finding out that it was the truck. But
right, also, it was a remake of a French film, yeah.
Right, and a great French film, but I think Sorcerer is even better. And just to throw out there too, you know, Stephen King is on record that it is his number one favorite film, and I definitely can see why. It's just awesome. So that was basically, now I'm a freaking guy because that movie has always been one of my all time favorites. And if you get to see it in an altered state, oh man, those colors. Oh my God. It's so intense.
and they finally, you know, it's so wild how it got denied a DVD release and then finally gets a giant ass Criterion Collection Blu-ray release and sells out.
I've got the Blu-ray is amazing. It looks wonderful. But, you know, I saw it a few times in the theater because, you know, like most people, I went to see it and I loved it.
Did it have a Laserdisc release too?
It might have, but I never had Laserdiscs. So.
It's not good.
I had it on VHS, probably recorded off of HBO for a long time, and I would watch that with my friends. We should go into Sorcerer a bit about why it's such an important movie. And one of the things that's interesting that's been on my mind recently about it is that, you know, I was never a big Genesis fan, but I like prog rock. And I'm a huge Jodorowsky fan. I collect everything Jodorowsky. And at the time that Genesis did the last Peter Gabriel album, The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway.
Right. What a great soundtrack.
There was at some point discussion between Peter Gabriel and Jodorowsky about possibly making a film of it, because Jodorowsky was also influenced by El Topo in the making of the plot of that, which is basically a Pilgrim's Progress of this character, Rael, who goes through all these underworld adventures to discover himself. And then I didn't know this, but part of the breakup of Genesis was that while they were recording that album, Friedkin contacted Peter Gabriel and asked him to come and join him in a project he wanted to create, to start to create a whole new kind of Hollywood. And he wanted to take Hollywood in a different direction. And he wanted to see if Peter Gabriel would work with him on that, with creating music or whatever. And that created a lot of tension with the band, that he was off working on making movies or whatever and not focusing on the rest of the band as much. And then, he basically was like, he dropped out. Gabriel couldn't basically stay with it because of other obligations to the music and for other reasons. And so then that film that Friedkin then completed after those meetings was Sorcerer. And there are quite a few books and discussions in cinema academia about William Friedkin and the New Hollywood. I wish I'd had time to research this more, but I recommend to anyone, if they're interested, this whole idea back in the 70s that, and even after, I know Friedkin has been on about this, about how Hollywood has devolved and degenerated, and he was looking for a new type of cinema, which apparently, definitely Sorcerer was his first main attempt at that.
That is beautifully said by you, my friend, that's very beautifully said by you, my friend, because...
Oh, yeah, thanks. But it bombed, and so then, of course... His vision for a new Hollywood was certainly set back on its ass.
Essentially, but unlike other filmmakers, again, he's part of that same circle of friends, even though he didn't really work with them. He went to the same film school as Lucas, Spielberg, Brian De Palma, Scorsese. Yeah. And I'm sure you know about his brief feud with Michael Mann.
No, actually, I don't.
Okay, so he did this little known picture. It was kind of one of, his unofficial sequel to French Connection, where he... To Live and Die in L.A. And that was basically
He did do To Live and Die in L.A.
Right.
That came out after French Connection too, right?
Right. But he took Michael Mann's star of that, William Peterson, from Manhunter. And then he kind of did a similar Miami Vice kind of style. And Mann was not digging that. He's like, you better give me some fucking credit. You took my star and you took my style in. I think that's
all I got to say about that is that imitation is the best form of flattery.
Yeah.
And anybody who's going to cry because somebody emulates their style is ridiculous.
Totally. And we've already talked enough about his social commentaries and how he likes to show people in jeopardy, unable to be helped. And he kind of wants the audience to be invested, but, I was able to do some digging on a cinephiliabeyond.org interview, which has some great rare behind the scenes photos of him. And, unlike other people, he seems to just roll with the tide. You see all these other filmmakers all the time, who plead out on, I don't know why my movie wasn't successful. And he's just kind of just like, the world wanted to see Star Wars, not a diss, just the truth. And
yeah.
I did
watch the documentary about him and his life just a few months
ago. Okay, so you did see that one. Okay, cool.
That's one thing you definitely get from it. He's just an extremely pragmatic. I wouldn't be surprised if he's got a bunch of stoic philosophy about, you just focus on what you can do and don't worry about anything else.
That, absolutely. It was great seeing him be interviewed by people who had worked with him after all these years. Ironically, that was kind of the first time I had seen him. I had seen, French Connection growing up on edited cable. And then, in college, you finally see Exorcist and you grow to like it and appreciate it for what it is and how influential it is. Mm-hmm. But I had seen plenty of his other movies growing up that, and as I applauded before, is like another filmmaker who I like because of how diverse he is, even though he doesn't maintain the same amount of monetary or critical success. I like how he tries something different each and every time. He does courtroom thrillers. He does Manhunt movies. He does other terror movies. He like Bug. He does Cruising, which, was going to be dead on arrival because first you got to make X amount of cuts just to not get an X rating. And then the LGBTQ community, even though they participate in the making of it, still find it pretty homophobic because it's just a sign of the 80s period in which it's made. So,
there's always a crowd that just feels like if there's a negative portrayal of a marge of any character within a marginalized community that looks bad, that they feel like it's a bad reflection on the whole community. And the movie rides that line. And so I understand why people get really upset that, like, oh, the serial, you know, the killer's gay. It, you know, even you can say the same thing about the Silence of the Lambs. It's like the caricature of that killer is so just, you know, hetero fear of anything queer kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, just let's make the killer freaky by just making him, you know, overtly gay. And I'm like, that's kind of offensive on a certain level. So I understand the objection, but, you know, the movie is bigger than just that stereotype. And, you know, I find Cruising just fascinating for its failures as much as its successes, because I really admire films that are ambitious and will give them credit for being ambitious way more than I will for their success if they're just a cookie cutter attempt at doing movies like
everything
else.
If it's just formulaic and building on the same stuff that's been done to death, then it's really not anything to talk about.
And that's what you just said. That's what you and I can agree on that we really appreciate about Friedkin is that he is always stretching himself, always trying new things and being innovative. You know, he's not just trying things that you and I haven't seen. He's trying things that he hasn't even dealt with himself. And, you know, the thrill of making a film for him is figuring it out as he goes, as opposed to doing stuff that he's already figured out and can do, you know, in his sleep. Like other directors who will remain unnamed.
Correct. There's many who just piss us off because they're just like very carefree or sloppy with their words. Or, and sometimes how many times have you seen a person whose work you admire and you love their movies, and then you listen to the commentary and you're like, God, that was a chore just to listen to, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And how are you so brilliant and yet so dull, you know, to hear, you know? So
right.
Sometimes the magic just happens, but. I pretty much just for this part two of the discussion, I just figured, you know, how about I just weigh in on, just what he's really keen on. And part of why he really loved working with Tracy Letts, the playwright and actor on Bug and Killer Joe, is that he was very, you know, he was an atypical kind of playwright. He wasn't kind of like a Tennessee Williams or Arthur mm-hmm. Miller type who kind of sticks with a lot of the same hoopla. And so that's kind of what he goes for. If he just identifies with the main character or some kind of sense of desperation, that's what he's all about.
Just on those two, I don't know Killer Joe. It's been on
my to-do list. Psycho thriller with.
I know what it is, but I haven't seen it. But I had the good fortune of seeing the play Bug before I saw the movie. One of my best buddies is an actor, and he was in a stage production of it. And it was, you know, it was a riveting play.
Was it pretty suspenseful seeing them recreate it on there? You know, when they got to use practical lights and other stuff to create an illusion, you know?
Right? But here's the thing with movies is that what they always say is that, you know, that you know, a stage play is so static, it's in one place, and a movie has to be different. So to take a story that takes place in one room, I mean, it's often a budget kind of trick, you know. Let's make a movie where a guy's stuck in a phone booth, or let's make a movie where somebody's stuck in a safe house, because then our budget will be super cheap, but we can get a big star. But, you know, he takes that room and delves into that space in such a cinematic way. Like the camera and the movement in that space is not static. It's almost mirroring the compression of the psychosis of the one character as it bleeds into the other as she starts she starts accumulating his insanity. And
yeah, they drive each other crazy.
Yeah, as a member of the audience, you feel like you've gotten kind of part of the Bug, you know, you've been sucked into it, and you can just feel how that process works. And, you know, stuff like that's a gift, you know, where you can actually see a psychological process play out like that in such a way that you can feel it. without having to actually go down that route of insanity yourself.
No, it's very true. He does make good use of the voyeurism in it, where we're along for the ride. We're watching this unfold very naturally, and even though it's a very unnatural thing that's happening. You know, I'm possessed by a parasite. And then we're having to see them again. Just the actors just really just click with it. They get that it could easily be a bad B pitcher in the wrong hands. But it's so much more spiritual and figurative. And of course, he was going to connect with it because, you know, he had done, again, plenty of other exorcism type thrillers that hadn't been as well received, like The Guardian, which was my co-host that last time was able to point out was meant to be a Sam Raimi movie. And, you know, the tones are just so drastically different. He's taking it so point blank serious, and he could have easily rewritten and stripped away some stuff that clearly was meant to be darkly comedic, you know.
So let me ask you a question, because the other two, you know, obviously the big films that I know pretty well are the French Connection films and The Exorcist. The night that they raided Minsky's, I know a little bit. So on those films, let me ask you first, because we just talked about him repeating himself. So the French Connection and the French Connection 2, you could take as two parts of one film. And so I don't have any issues with the second one repeating anything of the first, because they're both great movies, obviously. But then going to Live and Die in LA, I'm curious what you think, because sure, he was like, oh, you know, these movies are so New York, so let's take on more of this crazy Hollywood glitzy CNBC world that I live in, which has a bit of a Miami Vice kind of quality to it, because Miami Vice is really, if it's anything, it's Hollywood,
right?
And try to just do a variation maybe on the French Connection, because clearly even in that film he's like, I've done car chases before, now let me top that by driving the wrong way on the freeway. And it's an amazing sequence. But do you feel that To Live and Die in L.A. is really him stretching himself into new territory, or is it just him putting different window dressing on the same formula?
I have many friends and peers who love that movie. I have yet to re-see it, but I don't feel like it's really any different than any procedural.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I think it's a good movie. It's entertaining. But it's certainly not as creative and innovative as his other movies.
You kind of remember it because of the villain more than...
Yeah, that too. That too, definitely.
And while I do feel like every movie needs a good villain, there are some where it's like, yeah, but anytime they're off the screen, it's kind of a little excessive. And I do kind of enjoy parts of Jade, but that's another one where it's like, yeah, but then there's all this other junk in there that also doesn't belong. So I feel like you say, he... After Cruising and French Connection, he kind of just took unused elements that he hadn't used before and just recreated some of them again. And unfortunately, some of them were going to be raw, and some of them were still going to be kind of stuck in 70s territory, and it wasn't going to date well for an 80s or 90s crowd.
So. Right. I mean, I could see for him the whole idea of like, oh, I did the New York thing, now let me try the Hollywood West Coast thing, and I'll try a whole different genre and style, more like Michael Mann's. But it ended up not being much more than that. You know, I could see it being an interesting experiment for him, but it didn't create the kind of, you know, innovative film that he's done on other occasions.
Totally.
Yeah.
So
what about, go ahead.
In this interview, he also talks about what are his favorite movies and shows. He loves movies that are atypical, because he just finds many films of today are a fewer variety and numbered than are made 30 years ago. He praises horror films like The Babadook. He praises dramas like Creed, because they kind of hit on similar territory while doing their own voice. He praises cable TV shows that are able to have a very well-written story and be dramatic, such as The Sopranos, Homeland, X-Files, and 24. So pretty particular picks there.
Right, well, those are interesting because they're all from a time when that interview would have been taking place, but I bet he would be very...
Is very recent. This is like recent.
Okay, but then maybe that's just what he watched, because obviously we're in an era now where it's the golden age of, you know, TV that can be cinematic and like movies that can go on for 8-12 episodes so that you can tell longer storylines. And, you know, the amount of work that's being done in TV and streaming right now in terms of quality is just incredible. It's just, there's so much of it. But he also, I would say, you know, on the other end, he's talking about how he praises stuff up to recent times. I've also always been a big Fritz Lang fan. And, you know, he interviewed Fritz Lang for his own documentary and, you know, just, you know, really appreciating the innovation of the people who were inventing cinema, with Lang certainly being one of the great greats who not only pioneered the German expressionism, but made a pretty good translation into American films. I think his first American film, Fury, is absolutely brilliant. And then I watched one the other day on Criterion with Ida Lupino. I'm pretty sure that's who it was. Anyway, but it was just a procedural, like, press thing. I'm not going to go in. It just was not that great. Anyway, but yes, he praises great, great talent. And I think that is the sign of somebody who really is a great artist, who, you know, doesn't have to just hoard all the credit and can see other great artists. And I would, again, hold that against Michael Mann, that he's like, oh my God, you stepped on my territory and you owe me credit. It's like,
even though he's been doing the same thing nonstop, Cops and Robbers.
A little projection there from Mr. Mann.
And I think that's just it. Like, he did dare to go in a different territory. And if he couldn't relate to it in some capacity, he figured he was the wrong man for the job because he didn't know how to make it dramatic. In one way, you can say he played it safe. At the same time, he did a lot of movies that are hardly what you would call not edgy. You know, they're pretty edgy for the most part and hardly playing it safe. But I mean, even when he talks about, you know, not really doing diversity in his movies or even having strong figures, that's just it. I think he's just part of the times, and he just wanted to just basically just stick with what he knew. And I'll give him props for that.
I like, you know, Thief was one of my favorites when it first came out, but then I'm also a huge Tangerine Dream fan, so.
Oh, well, that's just it. He was able to use, Tangerine Dream for Sorcerer, and I think that's just it. I think, if anything.
I can't underestimate that. Tangerine Dream has done probably, you know, multiple dozens
Babylon 5
of soundtracks, but their very best one is the first. Like, Sorcerer, that soundtrack, especially the music in the trailer for Sorcerer. I don't know if you remember this, but in the 70s, that theme from Sorcerer was used in dozens of trailers for other movies.
I think I did hear it reused in a few different archive ones when doing research.
So powerful. That theme is so powerful. And if anybody out there in the audience gets a chance to look it up.
You can find it all on iTunes. It's one giant score, like one hour.
But hold up. But before Froese died, Edgar Froese, the leader of Tangerine Dream, they've gone on without him. They did a live concert of that album from beginning to end. And then and then a second half of music inspired by the score that continues those musical themes.
Oh, wow.
And it's out on a CD that's kind of hard to find sometimes.
$300,000.
But that that recording of the live version of the Sorcerer music is mind-blowingly great cinema music. If you want to sit down and put on the headphones and dream up your script ideas, I couldn't recommend a score any better than the Sorcerer score. It's so amazing. Both versions, the film version and the live version, both.
I couldn't agree more. And in many ways, they're all kind of part of the same coin. Tangerine Dream's doing atypical music. Michael Mann's doing violent procedurals, and Friedkin's kind of building on that and doing also just, again, you know, he was doing music documentaries. He did an episode of the Alfred Hitchcock Hour, which he actually disowned. He's like, man, I wasn't in my element. I was learning. It's a terrible episode. Didn't have a good script. I was on a sound stage. I like being out in the open where it's raw and real. And so it is interesting just seeing how, again, all these, again, guys born in the 60s, lived for the 70s, and then they're breaking out in the late 70s and early 80s, and they're having to find their voice. And I'll just say he got in when he could, and then he got out when he could, instead of just doing a project that he really did not want to do too many a time. There's only like two projects he does not speak about. He doesn't speak about The Guardian, and he doesn't speak about Dill of the Century, which is a satire he did with Sigourney Weaver.
Yeah, I remember it.
Did you see that? I have yet to see it. I've only seen parts of
ages ago, but I don't even remember.
Oh, there you go.
It's not very memorable.
There you go. And you can't blame him for trying something new. And at the same time, right. I think that's what I really like about him. When he's done something that wasn't great, you still see how it could have been something. What the filmmakers saw in it. It's just it got cut up by the producers or just didn't jibe. It just wasn't going to land with most people. And right. Any movie that, like you say, if it's bad, it's just kind of like, no sweat, you know, no skin off my back.
Let's hit The Exorcist here, because I wouldn't feel complete without it.
Oh, totally.
I mean, I don't think anybody can deny just the visceral power of that film. You know, it holds up today in the way that most horror films don't. You know, it's so powerful and
very suspicious.
Suspicious how?
Well, in that they're having to see who has the greater faith that will keep them alive, who has it in them to, you know, end this madness.
Mm-hmm.
And what's funny is Ellen Burstyn, you know, she's always acting, always showing up, always still in the show. And mm-hmm. I saw her get kidnapped recently on that Law and Order show. She's playing Stabler's mother, and everyone's like, oh no, are they gonna kill her? I'm like, yeah, I think she's got this. She survived an exorcism in her family.
Got this. But this is a little anecdotal, but my son is a grown man, but I used to take him to Comic-Con when he was a kid, so he still goes to them. And they had one up in Phoenix last weekend, so I went with him for the first time in ages. We went up together, and we walked the floor together. And you know, I bought a couple of shirts, but one thing I bought, and I'll tell you a little bit about why in a moment. You know, I was like, I like little figures, and I collect movie sort of props
and merchandise. Thing.
But they had an exact little statue of Pazuzu, exactly like.
Oh my God!
I was like, okay, I gotta have that. I'm gonna put that right next to my Hellraiser cube in my little bookcase.
Oh, nice!
I know exactly where that's gonna go.
It appears in Wishmaster. That's how iconic it is.
Yeah, and so what I have to say is just that when I watch The Exorcist, I'm always impressed that the body of the film is made so much more compelling and terrifying by that opening sequence. That opening sequence in Iraq just puts the spin on everything in such a intensely, what's the word I'm looking for? It's like, it's so ominous and it's so visceral watching that sequence. And then the way he finally comes on that statue. I mean, if you want to take the idea of an omen, you know, there's an entire movie called The Omen, but right. Nothing in that film captures the feeling of an actual symbol hitting you like an omen of something that's going to come and you don't know what it is.
That goes for Easy Frills.
Terrifying. And yeah, and your whole body gets goosebumps at like what that is portending, so that it sets you up. And that's kind of a key to the magic of filmmaking. I wonder if the film would have been as impactful or as even palatable without that sequence. Sometimes you have to psychologically set the audience up in advance so that when the actual horror hits, it's now believable. You've been shown why it's believable in the context of the film before you get there. And it makes the actual horror when it hits just 10 times more severe.
It definitely had a sense of his identity of where he mm-hmm. wanted the film to be set in the beginning, showing the source of the evil before, you know,
terrorists. Yeah, the source of the evil, whether it's historical and quote unquote
ancient.
Literal. And I don't tend to believe in literal things, but in the historical context, or just in the symbolism of what these people believe and the depth of their belief and how that, you know, affects them all going forward psychologically and spiritually.
1,000%.
Yeah.
And I'm actually listening to this cool podcast now called How Not to Make a Movie. And it's a fun podcast. It's by the two lead writers, the showrunners of the Tales from the Crypt show. And, you know, they talk about all the people, you know, how they got Michael J. Fox and Arnold Schwarzenegger to guest direct an episode, working with Roger Daltrey of The Who. And they mentioned out of all the biggest of the biggest people, they had to go out and find, and they had a bunch of opposition to. They were just like, you know what? Let's get Billy, you know, Friedkin from Exorcist. Let's get him on here. And Joel Silver, the producer, was so opposed to that. He's like, no. You don't want to work with that guy. I'm told he's difficult. And you're like, no. Let's get him on here. And of course, Friedkin was just as intimidated by them as they were by him. And they got along instantly. And he loved it. He loved the whole run and gun. He didn't even use the viewfinders or everything. He loved the whole just raw feel of it that he's like, I haven't loved working on a set like this in years.
Yeah, if anybody in the audience hasn't seen Friedkin do interviews or speak at film festivals, you'd be amazed considering how serious he is about his work and how people may say he's, you know, difficult or just very focused on what he wants to do.
A little delusional, but very emotional.
When you see him though with an audience at a festival or being interviewed, the guy is so freaking kind and so generous and so open. He's not running a big ego game. He's just focused on the work.
Those were the actors he dealt with. He didn't want to bring any more of that to the table.
So, he is a super nice and super generous person when he's giving interviews and when he's talking about his love of the work. And
I think he's probably seen more in documentaries than even some of his work of today. Because I see him constantly just appear in someone else's documentary talking about, oh, this movie changed the world.
So I would recommend to anybody who's interested in his work, you know, check out, you know, if you're a film student or want to, you know, see stuff about film, you could do far worse than to hear his two cents, because he'll point you in the right direction with giving credit.
It's not a time suck watching any of his movies. You'll at least know, you detect his voice over it. You sense his anger. You sense his intensity. You sense his, what he's afraid of that he wants to illustrate on screen. Just as well.
We like freaking.
Who does?
Follow us on the web on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The podcast is available on Podbean, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Anchor, Apple, and anywhere else podcasts are available. Feel free to review our show and leave comments on any of those sites. Thanks a million for listening. It's a jacked up.